Disjointed words popped through the static. 30 seconds! Move! Pursuit! The voice was unrecognizable, but clearly the message was urgent.
Is that him?
Asked Barnes. No one could say. Again, a burst of life from the comms, clearer now. They looked towards the open gate at the front of the little airfield.
I'm coming hard! Hold your fire!
Doolin replied into the comm.
Your signal is intermittent. Say again your location.
A pop of static.
Northwest!
Just then, they heard a crash to the north and a honking horn. Everyone had been looking to the south. They turned their heads and gun barrels north to the sound of the noise and saw a civilian pickup truck, one headlight dead and black, smash through the fence and bounce out of the sand and onto the tarmac. The truck was moving at an incredible clip directly towards the L-100. The voice came over the comms again.
I've got company!
Just then, headlights appeared along a wide track behind the wildly bouncing vehicle. First two sets, then four, then more. Doolin assessed the situation for 1 second. Then he called out to his crew over the engine's whine.
Up the ramp!
All five were aboard, and the L-100 was already rolling down the runway when an armed man in dirty gear and body armor sprinted up the back ramp. McVee grabbed the package's gloved hand and pulled him up the steep incline, and Markham slammed his hand on the hydraulic lift lever to close the ramp. Doolin gave a command to the pilots on the cabin intercom, and the four turboprop engines gunned for takeoff. With the ramp sealed shut, the package dropped onto his knee pads in the middle of the bare cabin. His M4 rifle was slung over a general-issue chest harness, missing most of its ammunition, and a brown Nomex tunic torn in several places. The man's face was covered with goggles, smeared grease paint, and sweat. He pulled his helmet off, dropped it to the floor of the cabin, already inclining during its takeoff rotation. Steam poured from a sopping mat of thick brown hair, and his beard dripped perspiration like a leaky faucet. Doolin lifted the gray man from the floor and put him on the bench along the cabin skin. He secured him to the bench with a belt and sat next to him.
You hurt?
He asked. The man shook his head.
Let me help you get your gear off,
Doolin shouted over the engines.
I'll keep it on. Suit yourself. Just a 40-minute flight. Once in Turkey, we'll go to a safe house, and tomorrow night Fitzroy will have instructions for you. We'll watch your back till then. I appreciate it,
said the filthy man through labored breaths. His eyes stayed on the floor as he spoke, his arms draped over the top of the black rifle hanging from his neck. The other four men had strapped themselves into the red mesh bench lining the side of the fuselage. They all stared at the package, trying without success to reconcile the average-looking operator next to them with his superhuman reputation. The gray man and Doolin sat by a pallet of gear strapped with webbing to the middle of the deck. Doolin said,
I'm going to call Fitzroy. Let him know we're wheels up. I'll grab you some water and be back in a second.
He then turned and climbed the steeply ascending aircraft to the front of the cabin. He pulled out his satellite phone as he walked. It was just after 3 in the morning in London, and on the 6th floor of a whitewashed office building on London's Bayswater Road, an aging man in a wrinkled pinstripe suit drummed his fingers on his desk. His face white, perspiration ran down his fleshy neck and soaked his Egyptian broadcloth oxford. Donald Fitzroy tried to relax himself, to remove the obvious worry from his voice. The satellite phone chirped again. He looked again, for the 20th time, to the framed photograph on his desk. His son, now 40, sitting on a hammock on a beach, his beautiful wife beside him. Twins, both girls, one in each parent's lap. Smiles all around. Fitzroy looked away from the framed photo and towards a sheaf of loose photographs in his thick hands. These shots he had also given 20 looks. It was the same four, the same family, though the twins were slightly older now. It was typical surveillance quality. The family at a park, the twins at their school near Grosvenor Square. Their daughter-in-law pushing a shopping cart through the market. Fitzroy detected from the angles and the proximity to their subjects that the photographer was sending a message that he could have easily walked up to the four and put a hand on each of them. Lloyd's implication was clear. Fitzroy's family could be gotten to at any time. The sat phone chirped a third time. Fitzroy exhaled fully, threw the photos to the floor, and grabbed the nagging device.
Stand still. How copy, full court? 5x5, stand still, said Doolin.
He pressed his ear tight into the earpiece of the satellite phone to drown out the engine's roar.
How do you copy?
Loud and clear. Report your status.
Stand still, full court. We have the package and have exfiltrated the target location.
Understood. What's the status of your package?
Looks like shit, sir, but he says he's good to go.
Understood. Wait one,
Fitzroy said. Doolin rubbed a gloved hand over his face and looked to the back of the cargo airplane at his four operators. His gaze then centered on the gray man, sitting at the end of the bench. Goggles, a beard, and grease paint hid his face. Still, Doolin could tell the man was exhausted. His back rested against the wall of the fuselage, and both arms hung over his M4. His eyes stared into the distance. Doolin's crew was on Gray's right, all geared up in a nearly uniform manner, but segregated from the package by a few feet of bench. 30 seconds later, Donald Fitzroy came back on the line.
Full court, this is standstill. There has been a change in the operation. You and your men will, of course, be remunerated accordingly.
Doolin sat up straighter, his brow furrowed.
Roger that, standstill. Go ahead with the update to the op specs.
I need the delivery of the package canceled.
Doolin's head cocked.
Negative, standstill. We can't return to the airfield. It's crawling with opposition and...
That's not what I mean, full court. I need you to... destroy the package.
A pause.
Stand still, full court. Repeat your last.
The tone of voice over the sat phone changed. It was less detached, more human.
I have a situation here, full court.
Doolin said, his own voice losing the clipped cadence of radio protocol.
Yeah, I guess you do.
I want him terminated.
Doolin's head was propped in his gloved hand. His fingers began strumming on the side of his face.
You sure about this? He's one of your guys.
I know that.
I'm one of your guys.
It's complicated, lad. Not how I normally do business.
This isn't right.
As I said, you will all be compensated for this deviance from the original operation.
Doolin's eyes stayed on the package as he asked,
How much?
5 minutes later, Doolin looked towards his men while reaching for his radio selector switch on his chest rig. He turned the dial a few clicks.
Don't say anything, just nod if you copy.
Barnes, McVee, Perini, and Markham all looked up and around. Their eyes found Doolin up at the bulkhead, and they nodded as one. Unaware, the gray man stared blankly at the pallet of equipment in front of him.
Listen up. Standstill has ordered us to waste the package.
Across the 30 feet of open space in the well-lit cabin, Doolin saw the stunned reaction on his men's faces. He shrugged.
Don't ask me, boys. I just work here.
The four men on the bench with the package looked to him, saw him to be the closest to the ramp, strapped in, with his M4 rifle on his chest and his bearded face gazing at the floor of the cabin. They looked back to their team leader and nodded slowly as one. Chapter 6 Court Gentry sat alone near the closed ramp of the aircraft, listened to the engine's whine, and tried to catch his breath, to get control of his emotions. His ass was on a mesh bench in the back of an L-130, but his mind was back down below. In the dark, in the sand, in the shit. The operator closest on his right got up and moved around the pallet, sat down on the bench facing him. Idly, Gentry glanced to his right, noticed the extraction team's leader adjusting his gear. He began to look to the other guys, but his head returned to the man at the bulkhead. Something wasn't right. The team leader's back was ramrod straight, and he had an intense expression on his face, though he wasn't looking at anything in particular. His MP5 was across his chest. He adjusted the glove on his right hand. And his mouth was moving. He was transmitting into his close-quarters radio, giving orders to his men. Gentry looked down at his own Harris Falcon radio set. He had been on the same channel as the rest of the team, but now he could not hear the transmission. Strange. Cort turned to the three men next to him on the bench. From their posture, from their facial expressions, Gentry determined that, just like their leader, they weren't decompressing after the tension of the extraction from the hot zone. No. They moved and looked like they were about to go into action. Gentry had spent 16 years in covert operations, studied faces, and evaluated threats for a living. He knew what an operator looked like when the fight was over, and he knew what an operator looked like when the fight was about to begin. Surreptitiously, he unhooked the strap securing him to the bench and swiveled in his seat to face the men around him. Doolin was up at the bulkhead. He was no longer transmitting. He just stared at Gentry.
"What's up?"
Gentry shouted above the engine's roar. Doolin stood slowly. Cort shouted again across the noisy cabin.
"Whatever you're thinking about doing, you need to just..."
Markham turned quickly on the bench, spun towards the gray man, his pistol already rising in front of him. Gentry pushed off the wall under the bench with his sandy boots and launched himself across the cabin, tried to put his body behind the pallet of gear lashed to the floor. The fight was on. The fact that Cort didn't know why the fuck his rescuers had turned on him was a non-issue. He did not waste a single brain cell pondering the turn of events. Cort Gentry was a killer of men. These were men. And that's all there was to it. Markham got a shot off with his Sig Sauer handgun, but missed high. Before Gentry disappeared behind the cargo, he saw Markham and Barnes quickly unhooking their bench harnesses. McVee was the only man on Gentry's left as the gray man crouched behind the pallet and faced the cockpit doors 30 feet away. Doolin was up by the bulkhead wall near the doors, and the other three operators were ahead and to his right. Cort knew that if he put down the man to his left, he would eliminate one of their fields of fire. So he rolled onto his left shoulder, emerged from behind the pallet with his M4 raised, and fired a long burst at the operator. The man's goggled face slammed back against the wall, and his HK dropped away from his fingertips. McVee fell back on the bench, dead. Gentry had killed him, and he had no idea why. Immediately, every man in the back of the L-100 began firing his weapon. 4 guns poured metal-jacketed lead at Gentry's position. Cort tucked tight down behind the equipment cache as the fuselage wall behind him began to scream, whistling as the holes made by a dozen rifle rounds allowed pressurized air to race out of the aircraft. The flight crew in the front of the cargo plane could not hear the shriek from the compromised skin, but they obviously heard the gunfire behind them, because they put their L-100 into a nosedive to drop to thicker air in order to lower the pressure differential and, hopefully, keep their aircraft from tearing to pieces. The nosedive created a seemingly weightless environment for Gentry and his 4 remaining would-be assassins. Cort's body rose away from the relative safety of the pallet and rolled in a pair of reverse somersaults, finally landing on the ceiling of the cabin and scooting along its back to the rear ramp, which was now the highest point of the cargo compartment. 2 of the gunmen lifted into the air as well, firing above them at their target. Gentry felt a pair of 9mm slugs from an MP5 stitch across the armor plate in his tactical vest. The force of the impact knocked him off balance for an instant, but from his position, completely upside down, he saw one of the operators had not unhooked his bench harness, and he kicked frantically in the air, strapped to the wall to Gentry's right. The man was a sitting duck. Gentry shot Perini in the head with his M4. His body went limp, his arms and legs danced with the weightlessness of the plane's rapid descent. For the next 10 seconds, the 4 men still alive in the cabin spun through the air like socks in a dryer. The team leader, Doolin, was below the others. He had managed to grab hold of some webbing on the forward bulkhead and hook his arm securely through it, and now he tried to aim his submachine gun at Gentry 30 feet above him. But Markham and Barnes bumped into Gentry as they all swirled through the air, completely out of control. Buttstocks, boots, and fists flew each time a target moved too close to engage with a rifle. Though the men had a sense of weightlessness, they were in fact hurtling towards Earth, dropping through the sky at maximum velocity. Only there was an airplane surrounding them and dropping as well, so they could see no reference points to prove to them that they were falling like stones. In the chaos, the screaming, and the confusion of losing hold of Terra Firma, Cort spun backwards again, and his hand slipped from the grip of his rifle, and its sling slipped over his head. The weapon twisted out of reach. He drew his Glock 19 pistol, raised to fire without sighting, but he felt the sting of a bullet as it tore into his right thigh. The impact kicked his leg back like a hammer's blow. He ignored the injury, and his feet found purchase again on the rear ramp. He looked up, which was now straight down, and found Doolin in his sights. The extraction team's leader had one arm wrapped in the bulkhead webbing, and he held his submachine gun over his head with the other, pointed up towards the gray man. Cort fired 6 quick rounds and saw the operator's body react as the bullets slammed into Doolin's groin and lower torso. Gentry next turned to get a bead on Barnes and Markham, his final 2 targets. But McVee's dead body sailed across his field of fire. Just then, the pilot apparently decided he'd seen enough sand in his windscreen, and he pulled quickly out of his dive. All passengers in the back, the dead and the living alike, now dropped through the air, slammed hard into the steel flooring of the transport, and rolled like bowling balls towards the front bulkhead of the craft. Cort's pistol flew free of his hand on impact, and he bounced forward, the sting from the gunshot wound in his thigh burning with each jolt. Cort rolled towards the netting on the front bulkhead as the plane leveled, almost got a handhold, but the pilot put the L-100 back into a climb. Gentry's momentum pushed him forward for a while, but as the cargo floor became a steep incline, passing 45 degrees now, he lost the last of his inertia, and his fingertips just barely managed to tickle the nylon webbing next to Doolin's motionless form. Then the gray man went backwards. He rocked back on his heels first and fell down, then slid, then rolled, and finally, Cort went airborne halfway down the length of the cabin. The pain in his thigh was compounded when he landed on his hip at the rear of the plane, but this pain paled in comparison to the excruciating crush of Markham's body as he slammed into Cort's chest. Markham faced the other direction and was even more stunned than Gentry by the violent impact. So the gray man easily got his arms around the operator's head. With a merciless twist, Markham's neck snapped, wrecking his spinal cord and killing him instantly. The dead operator wore his rifle around his neck on a 1-point sling, essentially a necklace with an automatic assault weapon dangling as its charm. Cort tried to remove it, but the sling was caught on the operator's load-bearing vest. Cort pulled the gun up to the dead man's shoulder, tried to quickly sight on the last remaining extraction team member, who was using the legs of the long bench as a ladder to climb up the cabin to the forward bulkhead loadmaster's galley. Cort pulled the trigger, but the weapon clicked empty. He fumbled around Markham's chest rig for another magazine and slammed it into the MP5's magazine well. He readied to fire at his target just as the man disappeared into the galley. The plane leveled off again, and Cort's gravity returned to normal. He stayed low behind the pallet towards the rear hatch, waiting for Barnes to peek back around the door. Without warning, Gentry heard a loud noise and felt the rear cargo ramp behind him move. The wind roared. Barnes had activated the ramp from the front of the cabin. A second later, the aircraft began another steep climb. As Cort scrambled to grab onto the netting over the pallet on the floor in front of him, Barnes appeared near the bulkhead. The dark-clad operator had slung a parachute rig onto his back. Apparently, he figured this plane had taken all the damage it could, or perhaps he worried the pilots were dead from stray gunfire. Barnes held the bulkhead webbing with all his might and fired burst after burst in Gentry's direction, one-handed, with his M4 as the ramp opened fully behind the gray man. Court reached behind him with his free hand and stripped the gun off Markham's neck just before the dead man rolled out of the plane and into the darkness. The pilot continued his climb, and soon McVee's body slid past Gentry and out into the night. Perini's body was lashed into his seat, and Doolin's corpse was still secured in the bulkhead webbing. Gentry and Barnes were the only two left alive. Court held onto the submachine gun with his right hand, and his left hand squeezed the net on the pallet. His glove had twisted on his fingers, and he knew he could not hold on much longer. His boots kicked at the deck of the plane to try to find purchase as the climb angle grew steeper and steeper. He was seconds away from falling backwards down the ramp. But Gentry had one last chance. He lifted Markham's rifle and fired a long burst over the pallet at Barnes, hitting him squarely on his chest plate, slamming his head back against the bulkhead hard enough to knock him out cold. The aircraft's incline was 45 degrees now, and the wounded Barnes lost his hold of the webbing, dropped to his knees, and rolled down the length of the plane towards the rear hatch. This was Gentry's ride off the damaged aircraft, and he did not want to miss it. As the incapacitated operator bounded past, Court let go of the pallet and pushed off the floor with his boots and knee pads. Gentry leapt to his right and grabbed hold of the unconscious man by the parachute harness, and they sailed together out the open hatch and into the night sky. Gentry hooked his arms around Barnes and crossed his legs behind his back. The L-100 disappeared above them, and soon the roar of the engines was replaced by the howl of the wind. Court grunted and screamed with the effort of holding on as tightly as possible. He did not dare reach for the ripcord of the chute. If he lost his tenuous hold, he would never find it again in the black night sky. He was reasonably sure this rig would have a Cypress automatic activation device that would pop the reserve at 750 feet if its occupant was still in freefall. Gentry and his would-be killer tumbled end over end through the cold blackness. One of Court's hands found a good hold on the parachute's shoulder strap, so he released the other hand to find a similar grip. Just as he let go, he heard a one-tone beep that lasted less than a second. Then the reserve chute deployed. Court held on with one hand. This parachute was not meant for two people, one of whom was kicking and yanking, desperate to get a firmer grip, so the men fell too fast and spun around like a whirligig. This continued for just a few seconds before Gentry began to vomit from the vertigo. He did not have far to fall, but his nausea had already turned to dry heaves before they slammed together on the ground. Court's impact was muted by landing squarely on the man in the chute. He checked on the other operator. He'd landed hard, face first, with Gentry on his back. Court found no pulse. Once on terra firma, Gentry got control of his heaving stomach, grabbed his thigh, and writhed in pain for a moment, and then recovered enough to sit up. The first hues of morning were glowing to his left, showing him the way east. Now that he had his bearings, he took stock of his surroundings. He was on flat ground, at the bottom of a gentle valley. There was a brook close enough to hear, and goats bleating in the distance. The dead operator lay broken, the reserve chute flapping behind him in a cool, pre-dawn breeze. Court searched the man's gear and found a medical blowout bag on Barnes's hip. He sat down on the grass and did his best to treat his wound in the dark. He assumed he had a long walk to reach the border and wanted to patch his injured leg so it could stand the trek. It was a clean wound, in and out. No major vascular or orthopedic damage. Nothing much to worry about if you treated it early and well and did not mind days or weeks of throbbing discomfort. Gentry puked bile once more, his body and his mind just catching up to the chaos of the past 5 minutes. Then he stood and slowly began walking north, towards Turkey. Chapter 7. Fitzroy sat across from Lloyd on the couch in his office. Even as the older man listened to the other end of the satellite connection, his angry eyes did not flicker away from the young lawyer.
"I see," said Fitzroy into the phone. "Thank you."
He terminated the call and placed the phone gently on the table in front of him. Lloyd stared back, hopeful. Fitzroy broke the staring contest with a gaze to the carpet.
"It seems they're all dead."
"Who's dead?" asked Lloyd, the tint of optimism ever growing in his voice.
"Everyone but the flight crew. I am told there was a bit of a dust-up in the aircraft. Cortland did not go down easily. No surprise there. The pilot found two of my men's bodies in the back, no sign of the other four. Blood on the floor, walls, and ceiling. Over 50 bullet holes in the fuselage."
"My firm will compensate you for the damages," Lloyd said it matter-of-factly. He cleared his throat. "But they did not find Gentry's body? Could he have survived?"
"It appears not. There was a lot of gear lost. The plane flew for miles with its rear cargo door open, and among the unaccounted-for items is a parachute. But there's no reason to assume..."
Lloyd interrupted. "If our target is missing out the rear of an airplane along with a parachute, I can hardly convince the Nigerians the job is done."
"He was outnumbered 5-1 against a Tier 1 crew, all ex-Canadian Special Forces. Clearly I have fulfilled my end of our bargain. I ask you to now kindly carry out yours. Stop your threats to my family."
Lloyd waved a dismissive hand in the air. "Abu Bakr wants proof. He demanded Gentry's head in an ice chest."
"Damn it, man," said Fitzroy. "I did as I was told."
Fitzroy was angry, but he was no longer fearful for his son's family. Shortly before Lloyd arrived, Sir Donald had called his son, had him collect his wife and children, and rush to St. Pancras Station in time to make the morning's second Eurostar train to France. At this very moment, they should be settling into the family's summer villa just south of the Normandy beaches. Fitzroy felt confident Lloyd's men would not find them there.
"Yes, you did as you were told, and you will continue to do so. I have a very quiet but very ominous Nigerian back in my office who will not leave with my assurances only. I will need for you to ascertain the flight path of the pilots, and I'll need to send a team to investigate..."
The phone on Fitzroy's desk chirped with a distinctive ring of two short bleats. Sir Donald spun his head to it, and then back up to Lloyd.
"It's him," said Lloyd, responding to Fitzroy's obvious shock.
"That's his ring."
"Then answer it and activate the speaker function."
Fitzroy crossed the room and pressed a button on the console on his desk.
"Cheltenham Security?"
The voice that came through the line was distant. The words came out between labored breaths.
"You call that a rescue?"
"It's good to hear your voice. What happened?"
Lloyd quickly pulled a notebook from his briefcase.
"I was going to ask you the same thing."
"Are you hurt?"
"I'll live. No thanks to the extraction squad you sent to pick me up."
Fitzroy looked to Lloyd. The young American scribbled something on his notepad and held it up. "Nigeria."
"Son, I heard from the flight crew about the melee. These were not regular employees of mine, just a mercenary unit I had used once before. I was rushed to get a team together after the Polish pulled out."
"Because of what happened in Iraq?"
"Yes. That whole sector has become a no-go zone after your little demonstration yesterday. The Polish refused to go in. The men I sent instead let me know they'd do anything for money, despite the risks. Clearly someone got to them, bought them off."
"Who?"
"My sources tell me Julius Abu Bakr, the Nigerian president, is after your head."
"How does he know I was the one who waxed his brother?"
"Your reputation, no doubt. You have reached the status where some jobs are so difficult or high profile that they just have to be you."
"Shit," said the voice through the line. Fitzroy asked.
Where are you? I'll send another team to pick you up.
Hell no, you won't.
Look, Court, I can help you. Abu Bakr leaves office in a few days. He will leave with unimaginable wealth, but his power and his reach will be lessened once he is a civilian. The danger to you will soon pass. Let me bring you in. Watch over you until then.
I can lie low on my own. Call me when you get more intel on the men after me. Don't try to find me. You won't.
And with that, the connection died. Lloyd clapped.
Well played, Sir Donald. Quite a performance. Your man didn't suspect you at all.
He trusts me,
Fitzroy said angrily.
For 4 years, he's had every reason in the world to think I was his friend.
The American lawyer ignored Sir Donald's anger and asked, Where will he go? Sir Donald sat back on the couch and ran his hands over his bald head. He looked up quickly.
A double! You want a head in an ice chest? I will bloody well get you a head in an ice chest. How the hell will Abu Bakr know the difference?
Lloyd just shook his head.
Weeks ago, before the president demanded we kill him, he asked us for all the intelligence we had on the Gray Man. I happened to have photos, dental records, a complete history, etc. I sent that to him, thinking the son of a bitch would just kill Gentry himself before the hit on his brother was carried out. Abu Bakr knows your man's face. We can't use a body double, or, as you suggest, a head double.
Fitzroy cocked his head slowly.
How the bloody hell did you come by this information?
Lloyd regarded the question for a long moment. He picked at a piece of lint on the knee of his pants.
Before I moved to Paris to join Laurent, the Gray Man and I worked together.
Your CIA?
X. Definitely X. There's no money in patriotism, I'm afraid.
And there is money in hunting down patriots? Threatening to hurt children?
Good money, as it happens. The world is a funny place. I copied personnel files when I was with the agency. I planned to use them as a bargaining chip if they ever came after me. It's just serendipity that these documents have proven useful in my current position.
Lloyd stood and began pacing Fitzroy's office.
I need to know where Gentry is now, where he's going, what he normally does when he goes into hiding.
When he goes into hiding, he simply vanishes. You can kiss your natural gas goodbye. The Gray Man will not turn up on anyone's radar again for months.
Unacceptable. I need you to give me something, something about Gentry I don't already know. When he worked for us, he was a machine. No friends, no family that he gave a damn about. No lover stuck away for those long nights after a job. His SAD file is about the most boring read imaginable. No vices, no weakness. He's older now. Surely he's made associates of a personal nature, developed tendencies that will help us figure out his next step. I'm sure you can tell me something, no matter how trivial, that I can use to flush him out.
Fitzroy smiled a little. He sensed the desperation in his young adversary. He said,
Nothing. Nothing at all. We communicate via untraceable sat phone and email. If he has a home or a girl or a family hidden away, I wouldn't know where to tell you to look.
Lloyd walked over to the window behind Fitzroy's desk. The Englishman remained on the sofa and watched the uninvited guest pace the office as if Fitzroy himself were the visitor and Lloyd was the proprietor of Cheltenham Services. Suddenly, the American spun around.
You can offer him a job. An easy job for big money. Surely he won't turn down a high-paying milk run. You send him on a new mission, and I'll have a team there to ambush him.
Bloody hell, you think he survived out there this long by being a fool? He has no interest in earning wages at the moment. He's busy blending into his surroundings. You had one shot to take him out, and you made a mess of it. Go back to your office and lick your wounds. Leave me and my family alone.
Fitzroy noticed a nervous twitch in Lloyd's face. It was replaced slowly by a smile.
Well, if you won't help me use Gentry's weakness to flush him out, I will be forced to use yours.
He pulled his phone from his pocket and smiled at Don Fitzroy as he spoke into it.
Pick up Philip Fitzroy and family. They're at their summer cottage in Normandy. Take them to Chateau Laurent.
Fitzroy rose to his feet.
You bloody wanker!
Guilty as charged.
Lloyd's tone mocked the Englishman. My associates will hold your son and his family at a secluded property Laurent Group owns in Normandy. They will be well taken care of until this matter is resolved. You will contact the Grey Man and give him their location. Tell him the Nigerians are holding your only child, his adoring wife, and their darling little kitties there. Tell him those black savages promised to rape dear mommy and slaughter the rest of the clan in 3 days, unless you give up your assassin's location.
What good will that do?
I know, Gentry. He is loyal like a fucking puppy. Even though he's been kicked around a few times, he will defend his master to the death.
He won't.
He will. He'll take it upon himself to save the day. He'll understand the police are useless, and he will move heaven and earth to get to France. You see, Sir Donnie, Court Gentry's compass never has pointed true north. He's a hitman, for God's sake. But all his operations, both with the CIA as well as in his private practice, have been against those he deems worthy of extrajudicial execution. Terrorists, mafia dons, drug dealers, all manner of nefarious ne'er-do-wells. Court is a killer, but he thinks himself to be a righter of wrongs, an instrument of justice. This is his flaw, and this flaw will be his downfall.
Fitzroy knew the same about Court Gentry. Lloyd's logic was sound. Still, the older man tried to appeal to the young solicitor.
You needn't involve my family. I will do as you say. I've already shown you that. You don't have to hold them for me to tell Gentry they are held.
Lloyd waved a hand in the air, striking down Sir Donald's offer.
We will take good care of them. If you try to trick me, some sort of double-cross, then I will need leverage against you, won't I?
Fitzroy stood and crossed the room towards Lloyd, slowly and with menace. Although he was easily 30 years older than the American lawyer, the former MI5 man possessed a larger frame. Lloyd took a step back and called out,
Mr. Leary and Mr. O'Neill, would you step in, please?
Fitzroy had given his secretary the day off. He was all alone in his workplace. But Lloyd had brought associates. Two athletic-looking men entered the office and stood by the door. One was red-headed and fair-skinned, on the downside of 40, with a simple business suit that bulged at the hip with the impression of a gun's butt. The second man was older, near 50, with salt-and-pepper hair cut in a military high and tight, and his jacket hung loose enough on his body to hold an arsenal tucked away from view inside. Fitzroy knew muscle goons when he saw them.
Lloyd said, Irish Republicans, your old enemies, though I shouldn't think we'll give them too much to do. You and I will be seeing a lot of each other in the next few days. There is no reason our relationship should be anything less than cordial.
Claire Fitzroy had just turned 8 years old the previous summer. It was the end of November now, and she and her twin sister Kate had expected to stay in London throughout the wet, gray, and chilling autumn without a break from the routine. Up each weekday morning early for the walk to her primary school on North Audrey Street, out of class and into thrice-weekly piano practice for Claire and vocal lessons for Kate. Weekends spent with Mummy in the shops or Daddy at home or on the football pitch. Each fortnight, one of the girls would have a friend over for a slumber party and, as the dreary London skies of fall morphed into the drier but drearier skies of winter, all Claire's dreams would turn to Christmas. Christmas was always spent in France at her father's holiday cottage in Bayeux, just across the channel in Normandy.
Claire preferred Normandy to London, fancied a future for herself on a farm. So it had been a great moment of surprise and adventure when the headmaster of her school stepped into the girls' class Thursday morning, just after roll, to call Claire and Kate out and back to the office.
"Bring your schoolbooks, ladies, please." "Lovely. Sorry for the intrusion, Mrs. Wheeling. Do carry on."
Father was in the office, and he took each girl by the hand and led them out to a waiting taxi. Daddy had a Jaguar, and Mummy drove a Saab, so the girls could not imagine where they were going in a taxicab. Mummy sat in the vast back seat, and she, like Daddy, was serious and distant.
"Girls, we're off on a little holiday. Down to Normandy, taking the Eurostar. No, of course nothing's wrong, don't be daft."
On the train, the girls barely sat in their seats. Mummy and Daddy stayed huddled together, talking, leaving Claire and Kate to run amok up and down the car. Claire heard Daddy ring Grandpa Don on his mobile. He began speaking quietly but angrily, a voice she had never heard him use with Grandpa Don. She stopped following her sister as they attempted to hop down the complete length of the car on one leg. She looked to her father, his worried face, the biting tone of his voice, words impossible to hear but impossible to interpret as anything other than anger. Daddy snapped the phone shut and spoke to Mummy. The only time young Claire had ever seen her daddy so visibly upset was when he yelled at a worker fixing the sink in their townhouse after he'd said something to Mummy that made her face turn red as a strawberry. Claire began to cry, but she did not let it show. Claire and her family left the Eurostar in Lille and took another train west to Normandy. By noon, they were in their cottage. Kate helped Mum in the kitchen wash fresh corn for dinner. Claire sat on her bed upstairs and looked out to the drive below, to her father. He marched up and down the gravel, speaking into his mobile. Occasionally, he rested a hand on the picket fence along the garden. Her father's anger and consternation twisted her tiny insides into knots. Her sister was downstairs, unaware and unworried, but Claire considered Kate the less mature of the 2 8-year-old twins. Finally, Daddy put his phone in his pocket, shivered against the chill in the air, and turned to walk back up the drive. He'd not gotten more than a few steps when two brown cars pulled in behind him. He turned back to the cars as men began pouring out. Claire counted 6 in all, big men, leather jackets of different colors and styles. The first man to Daddy smiled and stuck out a hand, and Daddy shook it. The other men filed around her father, up the drive and towards the cottage. Daddy looked to the men as they passed, and for an instant Claire saw his expression. It was first confusion, and then it was terror. And young Claire leapt to her feet in her little room. And when the 6 men, all as one, reached into their coats and drew big black and silver guns, 8-year-old Claire Fitzroy screamed.
Chapter 8. Kurt Riegel was 52 years old and as tall, blonde, and broad as his Germanic name implied. He had joined Laurent Group just out of the German Bundeswehr 17 years prior, worked his way up from associate director of security in the Hamburg branch office, through a half-dozen third-world foreign postings, each dingier and more dangerous than the last, and now he sat firmly ensconced in the Paris home office as vice president of security risk management operations. It was a long title, a fancy heading, that belied a simple explanation of his job. Riegel was the man one called if one needed something bad to happen. Off-the-books projects, black arts, human resource problems that required a visit from the heavies, black bag, sneak-and-peek burglary squads, corporate espionage teams, media disinformation experts, even hitmen. When Riegel's agents came to your office, it either meant they were there to help you clean up a difficult problem, or you yourself were the difficult problem someone had sent them to clean up.
leading the Department of Malicious Measures, virtually assured Regal would climb no higher up the corporate ladder. No one wanted the chief headknocker out in the daylight running the show. But Regal did not mind the glass ceiling above him. On the contrary, he saw his position as virtually a tenured one, as he had erected a security dynasty around himself. In his 4 years as VP of SRMO, his agents had eliminated 3 political candidates in Africa, 3 human rights leaders in Asia, a Colombian general, 2 investigative journalists, and nearly 20 Laurent Group employees who, for one reason or another, failed to toe the firm's heavy line. Only one man at Laurent Group knew of all the operations. Regal compartmentalized those below him well, and those above him in the corporation knew enough of his tactics to recognize they really didn't want to know any more. Problems arose, Regal was called, problems disappeared, and Regal was quietly appreciated. This made Kurt Regal an extremely powerful man indeed. The big German's teak-paneled office in the Paris HQ suited him well. It was, like Regal himself, large and blonde and strongly built, but quiet and discreet, tucked near competitive intelligence and IT in Laurent Group campus's southern wing. Along his office walls hung over a dozen hunting trophies. There was a taxidermist in Montmartre who virtually made a living on Kurt's African safaris and Canadian expeditions. Rhino, lion, moose, and elk all stared vacantly from their perches high on the walls around the room. It was also here where he did his daily calisthenics every afternoon at 5. He was nearly to his 100th sweat-inducing knee bend when his outside line chirped. Several lines he could ignore until he finished his set, but this was the encrypted number, the hotline, and he'd awaited this call for most of the day. He grabbed a towel, walked to his desk, and turned on his speakerphone.
Regal!
Good afternoon, Mr. Regal. This is Lloyd from Legal. Regal sipped from a bottle of vitamin-infused water as he sat down on the edge of his desk.
Lloyd from Legal, what can I do for you?
Regal's voice was powerful, like the artillery officer he once was.
I was told you would be expecting my call.
I was contacted by the chief executive officer, no less. Mark Laurent himself told me to drop everything and focus all my efforts on a project you will have for me. He also told me to supply you with some muscle and a communications specialist. I hope the technician and the team of Belarusian paramilitaries I sent have been helpful to your situation.
Yes, thank you for that. The tech is here with me. The muscle is down in France at the moment, and they are doing as they are told, said Lloyd.
Good. This is the first time Marc Laurent himself has called and asked me to pay special attention to an operation. I am intrigued. What kind of mess have you boys over in Legal gotten yourselves into?
Yes. Well, this matter needs to be cleared up quickly, for the good of the company.
Then let's not waste another moment. What else can I provide other than the team I have sent?
Lloyd paused.
Then he said, Well, I hate to shock you with this, but I urgently need a man killed.
Regal said nothing.
Are you there?
I am waiting for you to say something shocking.
I take it you have done this sort of thing before?
Here in risk management operations, we like to say that every problem can be dealt with one of two ways. A problem can be tolerated, or a problem can be terminated. If a problem can be tolerated, Mr. Lloyd, my phone does not ring.
Lloyd asked,
Are you familiar at all with the Lagos natural gas contract?
Regal answered immediately,
I suspected this would be in reference to the Nigerian fiasco. Rumor has it some fool attorney over there in Legal forgot to proofread a contract, and the Nigerians are backing out of a $10 billion deal we have already put $200 million into. I had a feeling I would be contacted on the matter.
Yes, well, it's a little more complicated than that.
Doesn't sound so complicated. I just need the offending attorney's address. We'll make it look like suicide,
The stupid bastard should be enough of a good company man to go ahead and kill himself. But you can't expect that kind of loyalty from a lawyer.
No offense, Lloyd, from legal.
No! No, Regal, you've got it wrong. We need someone else killed.
Regal cleared his throat.
Go on, then.
Lloyd told the VP of Security Risk Management Ops of the assassination of Isaac Abubakar, the president's refusal to sign the repaired contract without proof of his brother's killer's own death.
Kurt snorted. We climb into bed with these dictators, and then we act surprised when they grab us by the nuts.
Regal's English was flawless, idiomatic, American. He sat down behind his desk, grabbed a pen, and pulled a notepad across the leather blotter to him.
So, we need to ID the hitman and dispose of him? Asked Regal.
He has already been identified.
You just need him eliminated.
I was expecting something more complicated than this after Mr. Laurent's phone call.
Yes, well, this assassin is no slouch.
The trouble with private killers is all in the identification. If you know who he is, I'll have him found and dead within 24 hours.
That would be ideal.
I mean, unless we're talking about the Gray Man. He's a couple of cuts above the rest.
Lloyd said nothing. After the American's long hesitation, Regal said,
Ach so, we are talking about the Gray Man, aren't we?
Is that going to be a problem?
It was Regal's turn to pause. Finally, he said,
Certainly a complication, but not a problem. He is extremely good at keeping a low profile, hence his moniker. He'll be hard to find, but the good news is he will have no reason to expect we are coming after him.
Lloyd remained silent yet again.
Or will he?
I arranged an attempt on his life last night. It failed. He survived.
How many men did he kill?
Five.
Idiot.
Mr. Regal, the Gray Man is clearly no idiot. His history shows us...
He is not the idiot. You are the idiot. A damn lawyer who tries to orchestrate a hit on the greatest alpha killer in the world. Some poorly planned, cobbled together, hurriedly executed disaster of an operation, no doubt. You should have come to me immediately. Now he will be on guard, expecting whoever it was who organized the attempt on his life will just try again.
I am no idiot, Regal. I have his handler in my custody. I have persuaded him to help us locate Gentry.
Who's Gentry?
Cortland Gentry is the Gray Man.
Regal sat up as erect as a board and square as the desk in front of him.
How is it you know his identity?
I am not at liberty to say.
Who's his handler?
Regal did not like being the one on the receiving end of such information inside Laurent Group. He had his own intelligence network for that. That some shit American barrister was passing this intel around like it was common knowledge made Regal ball his fists in anger.
His handler's name is Don Fitzroy. He's a Brit, has a straight operation here in London, even does some work for us on occasion.
Regal's bald fists closed together tighter.
Tell me, Lloyds from Legal, that you have not kidnapped Sir Donald Fitzroy.
I have, and I have his son and his son's family held at a Laurent Group property in Normandy.
Regal dropped his huge shoulders and put his head in his hands. After several seconds, he looked to his speakerphone.
I have been notified in no uncertain terms that you are in charge of this operation. I am to provide you men, materiel, intelligence, and any advice I have.
That's correct.
Then why don't I start with some advice?
Excellent.
My advice, Lloyd from Legal, is to apologize to Sir Donald for the gross misunderstanding, release him and his family, retire to your home, put a gun in your mouth, and pull the goddamn trigger! Crossing Fitzroy was a huge mistake.
You can dispense with the advice, then, and just supply me with more men. Right now, I don't know where the Gray Man is, but I do know where he will go. Fitzroy will send him to Normandy. He'll be traveling overland, east to west. I don't know his starting point yet, but if you give me enough support, I'll send them everywhere across Europe to hunt him down as he gets closer.
Why will he go to Normandy? To rescue Fitzroy's family?
Exactly. He will be told Nigerians have kidnapped them and are holding them until Fitzroy turns him over. He will take it upon himself to rectify the problem.
Regal drummed on his desk.
I agree with your assessment. He does have a reputation as a paladin, and he won't trust the French authorities.
Precisely. I just need from you a surveillance team and a kill team. Right now your crew from Minsk is guarding his family in France, but I'd like Gentry dead before he gets to Normandy, as time is of the essence.
This is the Grey Man. You need more than this.
What do you suggest? I mean, other than me killing myself.
Regal looked up to the far wall of his office. The head and shoulders of a wild boar stared back at him. Slowly, Kurt nodded to himself.
To get this done in the time allowed, you will need 100 watchers.
You can get me 100 surveillance experts?
Pavement artists, we call them.
Whatever. You can provide that?
Of course. And you will need 12 teams of hunter-killers spread out and placed all along each possible route, coordinated by a central command center, each with an incentive to be the unit that finds and kills the target.
Lloyd's voice showed his astonishment at the scale of the undertaking Regal proposed.
12 teams?
Not company men, of course. Too many chances for comebacks on Laurent Group. Not local talent, either. Local boys would be known to local police, and that would compromise the hunt. No. We need foreign operators from parts unknown, as you Americans like to say. Hard men, Lloyd from Legal, if you get my meaning. Hard men who do hard jobs when no other solution can be found.
You're speaking of mercenaries.
Absolutely not. The Grey Man has either dodged or dispatched every gang of hired hitmen sent after him in the past. No, to be certain, we will need established field units. Government hit teams.
I don't understand. Whose government?
We have branch offices in 80 nations. I have good relationships with the internal security chiefs in dozens of third world countries. These men run stables of operators in their countries to keep their citizens and their country's enemies in check.
Regal paused while he thought through his plan.
Yes, I will contact my government counterparts in offices in the Third World, hard places where I am likely to find hard men without the faintest shred of scruples. I will contact these men, and within half a day of this very moment, there will be 12 corporate jets flying back from these armpit countries. Each jet will be packed tight with the baddest boys and the biggest guns, and each team will be tasked with the same mission. They will all be vying for the chance to kill the Grey Man.
Like a contest?
Exactly.
Incredible.
We've done it before. Admittedly on a smaller scale, but we've had cause in the past to bring in multiple teams to vie for a single objective.
But I don't understand. Why would these governments help us?
Not the governments themselves. The intelligence agencies. Can you imagine what a bounty of $20 million added to the coffers of the secret police in the nation of, shall we say, Albania, would do to the security and stability of the state? Or to the Ugandan army? Indonesia's Directorate of Internal Intelligence? These organizations work independently of their heads of state from time to time, when it suits the purposes of the organization or its leaders. I know which country's internal security apparatus will sanction their men to kill for cash. I have no doubt of it.
There was a pause before Lloyd responded.
I get it. These intelligence agencies won't worry about American retribution. They will know the CIA won't hunt down the killers of the Grey Man.
Lloyd, the victorious team will probably tell the CIA themselves, seek bounty from the Americans as well. Langley has been after the Grey Man for years.
He killed four of their own, you know.
Yes, I know. I like your plan, Regal. But can we do this quietly? I mean, without negative impact on Laurent Group.
My office maintains shell corporations for deniability's sake. We'll use